Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgain. The number of returned military veterans pursuing higher education has jumped in recent years. Their outlook can be vastly different from most of the student population.
Very typically, a service member joins when they're 18 years old. They go through their military service obligation and then they get out. And then it's like, hey, what's the next step? You know, and transitioning can be really hard for somebody who did that.
Conrad Wilson reports on how Portland State University is responding to the surge of veteran enrollees. Also on the show, how some Oregon middle school students are dealing with new standardized testing, and reporter John Ryan has the latest in the search for Washington State Auditor Troy Kelly's past business records. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgain. More and more veterans are going back to school, using the GI Bill to get a degree. In 2013 alone, more than 35,000 veterans in Oregon and Washington were using the education benefit to attend colleges and trade schools. With more vets on campus, schools around the country are figuring out how to help veterans succeed in the classroom. Conrad Wilson explains.
The Veterans Resource Center at Portland State University has already outgrown its space.
We see a lot of traffic in here, you know, anywhere from like 200 to like 700 people a month.
Ray Facundo runs the center. He says he served 3 years in the U.S. Army and deployed to Iraq twice. He points out that the GI Bill is an important recruitment tool.
A lot of people like myself joined for the GI Bill.
Facundo says that's because the post-9/11 GI Bill is so generous. The law dates back to World War II. The most recent version, passed in 2008, provides 36 months of in-state tuition, books, and a monthly housing stipend. Since then, the number of veterans using the benefit throughout the Pacific Northwest has grown. That's according to data from the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. Between 2009 and 2013, the number of veterans using the GI Bill more than doubled to 12,000 in Oregon and 25,000 in Washington. But even with the benefit, the transition from military to civilian life can be challenging.
Very typically, a service member joins when they're 18 years old. They go through their military service obligation and then they get out. And then it's like, hey, what's the next step? You know, and transitioning can be really hard for somebody who did that.
Facundo says the transition can be even harder for students dealing with things like a traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress disorder. Facundo was never diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury, but he spent 3 years near Army field artillery. In Iraq, Facundo says he was in convoy operations where he constantly saw explosions. He felt them rattle through his body armor. All that affected his ability to do schoolwork after his military service.
That makes a difference when you come back and you're trying to read a book for class and you're just stuck on that same sentence over and over and over again. And then the door slams or the fire station across the street, the alarm goes off and suddenly you find yourself under the bed, not knowing how you got there.
Veterans undergo big adjustments when they return, says Nick Armstrong. He's the Senior Director of Research and Policy at the Institute for Veteran and Military Families at Syracuse University in New York.
Going back to school, the educational experience itself is really part of a bigger transition that the veteran is going through generally out of the military. And so higher education becomes sort of one tool for veterans to, you know, reintegrate and reacclimate to civilian life.
Armstrong says schools can help veterans adjust by providing a central location with staff to help vets with things like managing benefits. They make veterans feel welcome on campus and can help them succeed at school. Thurston Spicer knows about that firsthand. He's an Air Force veteran. Now he manages the Veterans Resource Center at Portland State University.
Having a vet to talk to about vet problems is huge, is huge.
Spicer says he went to college in Tennessee at a school where there wasn't a Veterans Resource Center. He says anytime he had a question, he had to call the VA, which could take hours to answer a basic question. But Spicer says, having been in the military and used the GI Bill, he's able to help vets navigate the complexities of being a student.
Working here, we're able to provide a service to help all vets know what they have as far as their benefits, because their resources, what they can use to be successful in their transition from active military service to being a civilian.
Spicer says he hopes the center continues to grow and provide a sense of community as more post-9/11 veterans make the transition from military to civilian life.
I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
Students in Oregon have started taking new standardized tests this spring. They're meant to help rate schools and test if high schoolers have the essential skills required for graduation. The new exams are tough and different. Now, Rob Manning checks out the part of the test that is really different.
Oregon's exams for reading and math used to be all multiple choice. The new Smarter Balance tests are not. Nowhere is that more obvious than a part of the test called the performance task.
It is the most different, and it's the most different in terms of a test, but it's not really the most different in terms of everyday learning.
Kesley Down teaches at Springfield's Hamlin Middle School. Her students often do projects where they have to read, analyze information, and write about it. Those are the skills the performance task aims to measure. Its research project meets standardized test. Back in early March, Down was teaching research and writing while prepping students for this new kind of test. The performance task starts out being different for teachers. They spend half an hour walking students step by step through terms and concepts that will be on this new test.
We were trying it on for the first time too, and a scripted lesson is always a little difficult to kind of, you know, as a teacher, to take something that's just, you know, step one, and having to read it that way was a little difficult.
Then students study lengthy articles so they can answer brief and long-form questions. But Down laments that students couldn't do those steps on the computer like they will on the actual test. Smarter Balanced and other vendors offer interim assessments that students can take online, but they're not free and can take hours. Some schools are using those, but not Hamlin Middle School. These lengthy online assessments also tie up a school's limited number of computers. That's true even in Springfield, where voters passed a bond with more than $13 million for technology. Sue Rieke-Smith is assistant superintendent.
I think we're in a better place now than we were before the bond. Is it adequate? No. And do we need to continue to close the gap? Absolutely.
In the meantime, administrators want teachers to focus less on how the test works and more on what it is assessing: reading, research, and writing. Back in Kesley Down's room, sixth graders are in groups doing research. Students also worked in groups on the recent performance task practice. They researched animals that help people with disabilities. Sixth grader Stephanie Constantino recalls the essay portion had her composing an argument about the animals.
We have to get things from each source and make a paragraph out of it and explain our reasons.
Down says the performance task demands skills that students are working to develop.
You need those, the skills or the tools, such as two-column notes, reading, and citing their evidence, and making sure that they can prove what they think and why.
But students also learned something else: the multi-day research exercise, with its new vocabulary, unfamiliar subject matter, and difficult questions, is going to seem daunting. Sixth grader Kimberly Alvarez thought so.
Well, probably when you first look at it, you'll probably think it's really hard, but once you get the hang of it, it'll kind of get easy.
Easy? We'll see. These are lengthy, complex tests requiring stronger computer skills than Oregon's old multiple choice exams. No one really knows how students will do, but state officials are preparing for bad news. They project just 40% of sixth graders will pass the language arts exam.
And now a close-up look at one of the tests from students who have already taken it. Rob Manning continues with a review of a language arts performance task with the help of a few middle schoolers.
The performance task is like a research project under test conditions: 3 days of reading and writing. Seventh graders at H.B. Lee Middle School in the Reynolds District remember it was hard, but it's been a few weeks since they took it, and the details are fading.
This guy, I forgot his name.
I don't know what his name was.
Shay India Harris and Sierra Sims had similar tests. Trevor Vernon and Brianne Miller had different ones.
Mine was about people exploring Antarctica.
It's like about some
people living in England.
The test starts with a teacher offering instructions and vocabulary. Student Shay India Harris says the terms were key.
It's different words for, like, words that we use in class, because we don't use the same words that they used on the test.
Brianne Miller says it felt like a half-hour social studies lesson.
We kind of went over, like, the seven wonders of the world, and that kind of helped us take notes and stuff for the test.
The test took 3-hour-long class periods, and that's only one of the 4 Smarter Balance tests students will take. There are 2 math and 2 language arts exams for students from 3rd through 8th grades and in 11th grade. There's a multiple choice in math and language arts and a performance task for each. State officials say by now more than 6,000 students have finished the language arts performance task. Most are in 6th, 7th, or 8th grades. H.B. Lee 7th grader Sayara Sims lays out what students see.
You have 3 articles on the same topic, but like talking about different things. You read them, and you answer the questions, take notes, and then you move on, but you can't go back to those. And once you move on, you can still look at your notes, but you have to write an essay, and there's more instructions.
Shay India Harris says students got a clue from their teacher beforehand.
Mr. McDermott said it was a better thing to, like, read the questions first and then read the article. So when you go read the article, you know what you need to find.
Even with that clue, though, the readings were tough.
The first part, when you had to read, it felt long. It felt like I was reading forever.
Harris says the articles were also full of difficult terminology.
So I had to read it over and then over because I didn't get it. And then when I finally got it, like, it was like second day, then like it started getting easier. Then the third day, I just wanted to hurry up and like go, but I couldn't do that.
I definitely think that it was more difficult than it should have been.
Seventh grader Trevor Vernon says for him, it started hard.
And then it kind of got easier and then it got more difficult at the end.
The essay assignment varied from student to student. Some had to write an argument or an opinion. Brianne Miller says she had to write a narrative, a story.
I feel like it was harder than the other tests, but when you got to writing the stories or like taking notes and stuff, that really helped you make it easier. And it was more fun writing the story than just answering questions.
Trevor Vernon says he had to work hardest on the essay, and he thinks he did well as a result.
I think I did better on the essay, even though it was the hardest question for me, because I spent the most time on it.
The students wanted to see one more thing. Oregon's old exam gave students their scores right away. Sayara Sims misses that.
I like seeing the score at the end.
Scoring the written answers is expected to take weeks. I'm Rob Manning reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgain. Still ahead, agriculture versus fish is a component of water allocation in the West. With the cultivation of marijuana increasingly becoming legal, authorities are bringing the crop into the regulatory fold.
If you were growing tomatoes commercially, you've got to deal with permitting process through the county. You're going to have to deal with water quality control. You're going to have to potentially deal with water diversion and getting permission to do that. And we just haven't done that with marijuana.
Liam Moriarty reports on the results of a crops versus fish study recently concluded in California that could have implications for grows throughout the West. That story coming up right after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Partly cloudy today with light winds becoming north 5 to 10 miles per hour this afternoon. High temperatures today in the high 50s. Partly cloudy tonight with west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Overnight lows in the low 40s. Gordon McCraw, a meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says the high pressure will move east tomorrow ahead of the next front that will bring a chance of rain to the area tomorrow afternoon, with rain likely tomorrow night into Saturday. Scattered showers will continue behind the front into Sunday, with another front possibly affecting our weather Monday, and showers again Tuesday. High temperatures over the weekend will fall into the mid-50s and then the low 50s early next week. Lows under the partly cloudy skies could fall close to the mid-30s, otherwise they stay around 40 for the next few days. As marijuana cultivation becomes legal, regulations for growing the crop are evolving. The state of California is 4 years into a historic drought, and water for agricultural use is vying with the water needs of wildlife, such as threatened salmon. In parts of Northern California, an explosive and unregulated increase in marijuana cultivation is contributing to the problem. Now, a study says the impact of pot grows on fish-bearing streams is threatening their survival. Liam Moriarty reports.
Researchers monitoring water levels in streams in Humboldt and Mendocino counties last summer say the water impacts of cannabis grow operations are dramatic.
What we found is in four of the streams that had marijuana cultivation, those four streams went dry. And the only stream that we monitored that did not go dry was free of marijuana cultivation.
Scott Bauer is a biologist with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. He's also the lead author of a recently published study that found the proliferation of unregulated pot grows in the so-called Emerald Triangle is dangerously depleting the water needed for survival of salmon and other threatened fish. Bauer says the area has already lost some local fish populations to lack of water.
For coho salmon in particular, you know, they're on a 3-year life cycle. So if we lose 3 consecutive years of fish in any given watershed, we've essentially lost that run of fish.
Bauer's report attempts to quantify the problem by estimating the number of pot plants being grown in key watersheds and calculating how much water they use. The results are startling. In some areas, the amount of water calculated to grow marijuana exceeds the amount of water available in the streams. The report has generated some pushback from growers. The Emerald Growers Association opposes illegal water diversion and promotes environmentally sensitive growing practices. But the group says Bauer's report overstates the amount of water pot plants require by 300%. The group also says the report fails to account for the millions of gallons of stored water that growers use. Bauer acknowledges that his 6 gallons per plant per day estimate is based on limited data.
But when you go out on the ground and you see streams going dry, it's hard to dispute that regardless of what number you want to use, it's having an impact and it's impacting salmon and steelhead populations.
Last year, California lawmakers approved a pilot program designed to get pot growers to abide by land use, water use, and environmental laws. Chris Carrigan heads the State Water Resources Board Office of Enforcement, which runs the program. He says so far his teams have made more than 50 on-site inspections of grow operations on private land.
We've issued quite a few notices of violation, some cleanup and abatement orders, which require property restoration, and also some fines and civil penalties for violations of the Clean Water Act.
Carrigan says inspectors have found everything from illegal water diversions from creeks to unpermitted grading work to unsafe use of pesticides. He says some growers are coming from out of state to cash in on California's medical marijuana market. But many others, he says, are like the man who told him, "I'm a third-generation cannabis grower."
My grandfather started growing cannabis on this land in the 1960s. I want to make sure that I preserve the legacy of this property and be a steward of this land.
Carrigan's office plans to roll out a permit process soon that would put marijuana farmers under the same regulatory requirements as other land users.
Treat them like a dairyman. Treat them like a timber harvester. Treat them in the same way that you would treat any other business, because whether you agree with it or not, in California, cultivation of cannabis for medicinal purposes is lawful.
Carrigan says his program deals only with grows on private property. So-called trespass grows on public land, he says, are left to law enforcement. Jim Wood represents the 2nd District in the California Assembly. All 3 counties that comprise the Emerald Triangle are included in his district. Wood is sponsoring a bill that would make the regulatory program Chris Carrigan is piloting permanent and statewide. He says he's responding to the concerns of many constituents who say pot grows in the region are simply out of control.
The number of grow sites has grown dramatically, and the pressure on watersheds that is happening because of the unregulated water diversion is really reaching catastrophic proportions.
Wood says his bill is an effort to establish a regulatory framework for bringing cannabis cultivation into compliance with environmental laws, much like any other agricultural product.
If you were growing tomatoes commercially, you've got to deal with the permitting process through the county. You're going to have to deal with water quality control. You're going to have to potentially deal with water diversion and getting permission to do that. And we just haven't done that with marijuana.
But even beyond the bill itself, Wood says he's trying to send a message to urban marijuana consumers.
There is a price that we're paying environmentally for the weed that you're smoking, and you need to at least be aware that that's happening.
Wood hopes that awareness might contribute to political support for ending the environmental abuses of a lucrative but unregulated cannabis trade. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
Before Troy Kelly became the Washington State official most responsible for sniffing out government fraud and waste, he was a state representative. And like most state legislators, he had other work. Now he's being investigated by federal prosecutors for his past business practices in the real estate sector. Kelly has not been charged with any crime, and he has issued a statement saying he has done nothing wrong. We don't know exactly what the Justice and Treasury Departments are investigating, but determining whether Kelly's business broke any laws could be difficult, since his records concerning millions in disputed fees are missing. John Ryan reports from Seattle.
The Stewart Title Building in downtown Everett was destroyed by a fire in June 2008. Kelly has said the fire also consumed his business records.
Flames lit up Everett and destroyed a downtown building. Firefighters were afraid that fire would spread.
Kelly's business was based in Tacoma, but an employee of Kelly's had been working in the building next door to Stewart Title in downtown Everett. Kelly's firm did a lot of work for Stewart Title. Kelly said his business stored records and a laptop inside the building that burned down.
Molly, there's not much left of the Stewart Title office building here in Everett. In fact, fire investigators told me a short time ago this building is still too unstable for them to go inside. And that has a lot of folks wondering what happened to all those important documents.
A couple years later, what happened to important documents that might have been lost in that fire was still a big question. You could call it the $3.8 million question. That's the amount in loan fees that homeowners and three title companies said Troy Kelly had kept instead of refunding as required. So a group of homeowners subpoenaed Kelly's business records. Kelly's lawyer said, sorry, they were all destroyed in that fire. A title company called Old Republic tried to get the records from Kelly, too. Here's Old Republic's attorney, Scott Smith, questioning Troy Kelly under oath in a deposition in 2010. Smith wants to find out what happened to Kelly's records, including a key spreadsheet showing all the disputed loan fees.
Weren't you claiming almost immediately after the fire that you lost all of your records from your business?
Most of my records were lost in the fire, correct.
But the spreadsheet, which is a pretty critical piece of evidence, was something that may have been in paper form. It may have been posted on a web. But isn't it true that it was also on your computer and the computers used by several of your employees?
I did do uploading from my computer occasionally. I did not save a file all the time. Sometimes I did, so it may or may not have been on there. I don't think it was anywhere else. It certainly wasn't on numerous computers all over the state of Washington like you're stating.
The company whose entire building was destroyed in that fire said it didn't lose any records. Stewart Title put out a press release the next day, assuring homeowners that their real estate records were safe. Here's what Carl Jorgensen with Stewart Title told Como TV.
Those legal documents? No, they have not been lost. We lost no data. We back up everything virtually on the minute as it's put in our system.
The building next door where Kelly's employee had been working suffered smoke damage, but little more. And that employee testified that Kelly had shut down the Everett office a few weeks before the fire. During his 8-hour-long deposition, Kelly explained why the records he was required to produce under a subpoena were gone from each different place they used to be. The laptop in the Everett office, he said, was glitchy, and he'd given it to Goodwill, no receipt. Kelly said he had shut down his whole business after losing one of his biggest customers, so he no longer had his website, Yahoo emails, or any online records showing what happened to the millions in contested fees.
That's what made the claim so unbelievable.
Here's Scott Smith.
It wasn't just papers being destroyed or burned up in a fire in Everett, but the obvious follow-up question is, what about electronic copies? What about things in the cloud? And it was laughably absurd.
Troy Kelly declined to speak to KUOW for this story last week. He did ask his executive assistant to make sure I'd seen the fire marshal's report. Local and federal fire investigators could not pinpoint the cause of the fire, but they said they found no evidence of arson. Before the federal judge could get to the bottom of what happened to all those missing records, Kelly and Old Republic Title reached an out-of-court settlement. Kelly paid an undisclosed amount to settle the claim that he had taken more than $1 million in fees that weren't his. The dispute became an issue during Kelly's campaign for state auditor in 2012. Old Republic offered to make the terms of the settlement public then, but Kelly declined. I'm John Ryan in Seattle.
And that is all for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the home page. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1. That's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.